Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
The wait is over. The Chi returns with new episodes on Paramount Plus.
What brings you to the Chi?
Opportunity.
Everybody get down! Walk right up to
the side. A new rain is coming to the South Side.
Never should have sent a boy to do a woman's job.
The Chi. New episodes May 10th. Visit ParamountPlus.com/The Chi to get a 50% discount off the Paramount Plus with Showtime annual plan. Offer ends July 14th. Subscription auto renews. Restrictions apply.
Welcome along to another edition, another Texas edition of Kicking It. And we have a USA legend in the building this time, former US men national team goalkeeper Tony Mueller. It's so good to have you with us. You're the first, like, OG that we have had on the show. So
it's a very old introduction.
Original gangster.
But it's very cool to have you with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I will say I'm a little nervous. I was nervous since you guys, I've watched it. I've watched every episode. Just incredible
and
stuff.
And what makes you nervous? What do you think we're going to ask you?
I don't know. That's the problem. No, the truth is, I just hate talking about myself, man. Like, I don't work on the radio or TV. I make it a point to try and never talk about myself or sound like that person who, like, never made a mistake or did it all, you know, that kind of analysis. And
Is that a humility thing because I don't want to be center of attention, or is it like a privacy thing, like, hey, you all don't need to know
my
business?
No, I think it's a humility thing because I think, like, I look at it like if you care about me, like, you can go on the internet and find some information out or, you know, something, or go watch a game. I've never sat there and watched a game. I came home. I'm going to say about...
Even with your kids or something?
I came home. I was going to tell you, I came home about 5 years ago. My kids were sat on the couch. And they were watching a documentary about the two Escobars, you know? Yeah. And the game video came up. And I will say I sat down because of the story, but I was uncomfortable when the game video came up. Like, I don't know why. I just don't... I don't. I feel like I just want to... I'm always going, like, the next step, and I'm never really looking back. And maybe one day I will. We just moved. This was the coolest thing. The moving's not the coolest thing. It's about the worst thing in the world.
Right? Packing up boxes, I'm back.
But I had this bin that had all the jerseys that I collected. And I have pictures on
my... Other players' jerseys.
Other players' jerseys. And I started going through them. That was the first time I ever, like, relived, like, this is when we were in Italy in the World Cup. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm, like, grabbing these jerseys and throwing them, like, man, someone would probably love to have every one of these here, and I'm taking it for granted that I have these things.
What's the best one you got?
Well, I think my first World Cup jersey, even though we got our asses kicked against Czechoslovakia, you know, your first World Cup game is kind of hard to forget. Mm-hmm. And for me, growing up as an Italian-American kid, if I could think of two places in the world that I would want to play a World Cup, I played 1990 in Italy, and then the following World Cup was in the U.S.
Right.
Right? So I couldn't have, like, it was like we warmed up.
As an Italian-American.
Right, like we warmed up a little bit in Italy, you know, we kind of, it was the first team and you know, that made it in 40 years. So that was our warm-up, our appetizer, and then we got to the World Cup. My parents were born in Italy. They didn't come here. I'm first generation. I grew up speaking Italian when I was a kid. I didn't speak English until I was 5 or 6 years old. And here I am in Rome playing Italy. And I'm like, holy shit, like, how does this? And so the story behind it, we still don't know who my father was rooting for. He hasn't ever really said, right, who he was rooting for. My mother clearly was rooting for us. But my grandmother was in the stadium before she passed away. And she was almost blind. And I have this picture that was a picture that was taken by, like FIFA, like by the World Cup Committee. Not a picture that my family took, but here's my grandmother. You can see in the picture my family, and my grandmother was, she had her hands up. So I was asking my dad, I said, you know, what was Nona, we call her Nona, what was Nona doing? And my mom's like, she was trying to feel you in the game because she couldn't see. She was losing her. So here's this picture that I'm flipping through a FIFA book, and I'm like, oh, that's my family, you know? And then my grandmother's like on the side, and she's like doing this, and she's trying to feel the game. So like,
wow,
that experience, crazy. like that wasn't planned. That just kind of happened, you know? So it's so cool. But I was going through those jerseys, and that was kind of the first time that I ever like rewound a little bit, because I
enjoyed the nostalgia.
Yeah, I did a little bit. Yeah.
Tony said, first World Cup game you never forget. What was yours?
Mine was against Italy, actually. The year that they won the World Cup in 2006, it was the second game.
Did you score that game?
No, Beasley scored, but it was called back. But that was my first start in a World Cup representing my country. So, you know, going against Totti and other players like that. And I mean, it was a real special moment. But my favorite moment is the first goal in a World Cup, which came against Ghana. Also, the first game versus Czech Republic when they beat us 3-0, and thinking, damn, this is another World Cup that's going to go by that I'm not really going to play, because I played in a U-20 World Cup in UAE, and I hardly played at all. So that's kind of was my thoughts after that first game, like, damn, bro, this is another World Cup. It's going to come and go, and I ain't going to really do shit. And then got the chance to play against Italy in that game, and we tied them, and, you know, they ended up winning the World Cup. So
that's cool. I would say the best jersey I kept for myself was scoring against Mexico at Azteca Stadium. I had always dreamed of playing in that game. And so after the match, I don't think you're even supposed to trade with Mexico. Like, I've never seen someone swap jerseys with a Mexican player. Yeah, I feel like you don't do it. So I was making sure that I could keep my kit, and I snuck it in my bag and took it home.
Who did you trade with?
I didn't trade with anyone.
Oh, you kept your
I kept
jersey.
My own
You
jersey.
Wanted that shirt. Did you frame it? Do you frame your shirts?
Mm-hmm.
You do? Think you'll frame yours? Are you going to embrace kind of like reminiscing a little more?
I have
more?
A couple framed. I have that Zenga one framed that's not hanging up in my office now. When I get on Zoom and when we do our radio show, I've got my first World Cup jersey on one side. Behind me, it's hard to see because it's behind me, but I have the 2002 team behind me because I still think that is one of the best teams we've had, you know, when you talk about different cycles. And then above me to my right shoulder is my high school jersey.
Oh,
it's
wow.
My high school soccer jersey. Yeah.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
Did you have the 2002 one surprises me, because that you weren't like a star on that team, right? Whereas in 1990, 1994, yes, you were.
I'll tell you why, because I played in 90 and 94, and Steve Sampson left me off the 1998 team.
Uh-huh.
And I had to fight the most to get to the 2002 team.
What was the excuse that was given to you for being cut?
So Steve Sampson told me that he wanted bigger goalkeepers. Yeah, so I was the smallest of the crew.
How tall are you, Tony?
6'1".
I mean, were you significantly smaller than the other guy?
Looking like a linebacker, I'd be scared to go up for a header against
him,
that's for sure.
But I could jump through the roof and...
Did you feel like it was a truthful reason?
Yeah, it was a weird cycle. So that was 1998. In 1997, I believe it was January camp in Orlando. I was out of the national team picture, but I was killing it in MLS. I really was playing probably the best that I've played. And I get a phone call. I'll never forget it. I get a phone call, and I'm with my dad in this house that we had just moved in Montclair, New Jersey. And we were ripping floors up in my house, literally ripping up the floors. And the phone call I get from Steve, and he says, hey, are you going to be in California anytime soon? I said, matter of fact, I do my preseason training all the time in Redondo Beach. Jerry Rice used to go run up the hill, and we used to go with the NFL guys and do that little valley run, you know. And we made an arrangement to meet somewhere near his house, and I went there, and I got there, and he sat down, and the first thing he said to me is, "I'm going to bring you into national team camp." I said, "Oh, you know, I was thrilled. You know, you're going national team. I hadn't been there for 2 years. I left the national team in 94 just to deal with some family."
You've never really talked about why you left.
It's all good, bro. Take your time.
Yeah. So, you know, 2 years was...
Can I ask you a question? Is the tears because that time was so hard? Because stepping away from the team was so hard? Like,
no. Stepping away was easy. You know, it's your family, right? This is a freaking game, you know? Yeah, the time was hard. It's still hard, actually. So the game was all, you know, you guys know when stuff happens, it's like 2 hours of freedom, you know?
Yeah.
You go there, you're like, oh, God, just get away from everything for a minute. You know, just 2 hours, just like, you're almost like, just leave me, I'll do anything for 2 hours, you know? Just leave me alone. Just like get everything out of your head. And that's where I was. So I go to this meeting with Steve, and I always thought I had a good relationship with him. And he says, "Hey, I'm going to bring you into the national team." And I was thrilled because, you know, I was basically beating myself up because of life that was going on around me. And he says to me, he looks at me and he goes, "But there's going to be one thing. You're going to show me respect." And I was like kind of thrown back.
And you never felt there had been disrespect?
Never,
so.
Never. And I kind of started to sense like this isn't Steve. Like this is the Federation. Like I sensed like this is U.S. soccer. It's not really Steve because I don't see Steve that way. So I go, okay, well, you know, when you want to go to the national team, you do whatever. Our coach says, you know, go jump off of, you know, the mountain. You go jump, yeah. Right, because you want to go to the national team. They do anything. So we get to camp, and we go through camp, and camp goes great. We get to the game, and a soccer official, come, I won't tell you who it was ever, I never will, comes up to me and said, literally, like on my shoulder, says, "I swore you'd never wear this jersey again."
Damn.
I'm like, holy shit, man.
So they really held it against you that you decided to take a time out.
Yeah, it.
That's gotta, seeing how painful whatever it is was for you in that period of time, that has to hurt that you feel like, hey man, I gave everything to be part of this team. I just needed a minute for me personally.
And I always thought, because 94 was the first World Cup I got to watch as a kid, and you were like this big goalkeeper that, you know, was almost like Captain America. You were always, and after that World Cup, it was like, I know there wasn't MLS, so you're trying to figure out what.
Well, there
was
supposed to be, right?
Right.
The following year, but yeah. Then it happened 2 years. Remember, we were supposed to start in 95, right? In I guess February of 95, which would have been what, like 7 months later? But then in December, they decided to push it back 1 year, and that's where I got stuck. Right there.
So it's like, where, you know, what are you doing? And then it was like, oh, you're going to kick for the Jets or you're going to act. And I was like, oh, are you doing kind of like a Michael Jordan thing where it's like, I'm good with soccer?
Well, a couple things. One, you had to make a living, right, to
right.
do something. But that wasn't necessarily it because I was fortunate in 94. I mean, I had two offers that were written on the table. The first one was from Botafogo. I always wanted to go to South America, was in Brazil. And the other one was from Southampton. And I was convinced I was going to Southampton, but in my brain, I was like, I just lived in California for 18 months. I got to deal with this stuff at home. And I'm like, I can't go to Southampton. You know, like I can't now move an ocean away, right, to go. And that's kind of when everything started. So, but my thought was, okay, here's this 7 month period that I got to kind of manage, right, just to get to February of 1995 or March, whenever we were going to start. And then they, like, the rug was pulled out. I don't know if you guys remember Roger Twibel. He said to me, have you ever thought about kicking in the NFL? He was not a big soccer fan, but he saw me kick, you know, a soccer ball. He's like, you ever thought about kicking the NFL? And I'm like, yeah, it was always a dream of mine to kick in the NFL. I literally said it like that. And then when I was done with the World Cup and we were a month later, I get this call that they, like, Pete Carroll wants me to go try out for the Jets. Pete Carroll was the coach. I'm like, man, Pete Carroll, you know Pete Carroll, you know? And I'm like, cool, I'll go. And I thought it was going to be like a stunt, like they were going to do, you know? I didn't know I was going there. So anyway, for 2 days, I go to high school with my best friend, Sal, and we're kicking footballs. And I'm like, I don't know if it's good, if it's bad. I have no barometer, you know, nothing. I'm just kicking the ball. So I go there, and the media guy meets my agent and I at the front door. He goes, we just signed Ronnie Lott to the team. And if you remember Ronnie Lott, we have Boomer Esiason here. He goes, we've never seen so much media here. There's media from all over the world. He's like, I'm like, well, no one told me about this.
Oh, right? Damn.
So I go out, they give me like a jersey and a uniform. That's the one that's on the football card that is out. And here I am in front of all these guys kicking a football. So I kick, I do what I did, and I go inside, and they're like, we'd like to sign you. Literally like that. This whole thing, from the time I pulled up to the front door of the building to the time that I got into the GM's office, was probably 45 minutes total. And they're like, we want to sign you. So they cut a check. It was $29,000. They cut a signing bonus check for that. And I'm like, well, I gotta tell my wife. I gotta do something, right? I gotta call my parents or something. It's just me, my agent, like, and all these people. I have no, if it was soccer, like, you knew everybody in the room. I knew nobody. So anyway, I was like, okay, well, this thing doesn't start until, MLS doesn't start until February, so I'm gonna do it. I said, I didn't wanna be the guy, Kate, that said, like, when I'm 55 now.
That looks back.
Yeah, looks back and goes, God damn, I should've went to kick when I had the chance, you know, like, that's not me, you know, it's never been me. And, you know, I was there for, I guess, 11 weeks of the season. And then right after that, I thought I was going to MLS a couple months later, and that gets pulled out. So I played with the Long Island Rough Riders. We had a great team. It was, at the time, was the highest division we had in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I had to bridge the gap somehow. And that's how I bridged it, playing in that team with Alfonso Mondello, who was our coach. Yeah, it was so such a great time. And then MLS started and we rolled, man.
Do you have to provide for your family at all during that stretch?
No, I was lucky during the World Cup. Federation paid us for the time that we were in Mission Viejo, which was an 18-month period.
Right.
And we were in tiers. They actually brought us in tiers in meetings. So they tiered, like, the top four players, you were going to make this. And the next four players, and they brought you in a room, and they're like...
And everybody knew.
And like, us four go in the room, and Sunil Gulati said, you guys are our top tier. This is what you're going to make, you know, basically. And Bill Nuttall was the general manager back then, and that's how it went.
That's
wild.
They tiered you.
That wasn't like that with us. Everybody made the exact same.
Well, that was the bonuses, right?
No, that was everything.
Oh.
I mean, bonuses would be a little bit different in terms of World Cup qualifying. If you played more games than another person, well, then you made a little bit more money. But normally, when you just played in a game, whoever was in the 18, y'all all got paid the same.
Yeah, we did that with the bonuses, although ours weren't nearly as much back then. Our bonuses to win, I think if we won... I'm going to guess, you're going to laugh. If we won a World Cup qualifier, I think we made $350 in bonuses.
Dang.
What would a top tier player, I mean, if you're comfortable saying, what would they have been making?
It was six figures. Yeah, they were paying you six figures back then. I think everybody was that went to Mission Viejo.
Okay.
one of the advantages, like if you were married, you had an extra room in your apartment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in case you had family come over. So I was living in a two-bedroom. I had a two-bedroom.
That's crazy.
And then we didn't have roommates.
That's crazy. Our per diem was more than that.
Oh, I know.
Oh, when
I
what?
In 2002,
the per diem was more than
$350. Yeah, in 2002, it was like that too. And I was thinking all the time, I'm like, oh, we're making more in per diem to wash our clothes than we made to win a World Cup qualifier in 1989. You know?
Hey, that's a high per diem, isn't it?
I mean,
no?
I guess they feel like whatever meals they're not providing during the day, like you get paid.
Right.
For it, yeah.
That's why you're always asking CBS for that per diem,
hey,
huh?
Hey, don't make money, don't make sense.
Can I ask a question, and not wanting to dig into something sensitive, but the U.S. Federation, you feeling like they held that against you, that's one thing, right? Because they're not your people necessarily, right? But I had read some of the comments of like teammates, people I assume that you had kind of like a closeness to, who expressed an opinion on you acting or expressed an opinion on you going after the NFL. Did you feel supported by your teammates during that period of time?
Yeah, I never felt anything. I mean, everyone always asked this, especially about the NFL thing, because I think there's always, this inherent bug to know if you can do it. Like, if you can kick a football. I don't know if you guys ever felt like that. Like, hey, I think I could do that, you know?
Yeah, I think with anything. Shit, going out there, shooting a basketball, seeing if you can make threes.
Right.
I mean, whatever. Even if it was like a tennis racket, being an athlete, a competitor, you're like, well, shit, let's see if I see what you can do. So,
right.
But I think it's crazy that at the highest level, to put yourself in that situation to do it, like, I commend you, man. It takes a lot of guts to kind of, like, you didn't know what you were getting into, but once... you know, you made the team, you're like, all right, fuck it. Let's see how this goes, man. So
Did they have more acceptance because they knew what you were dealing with personally, or you locked down on
that? No, they had no idea what I was dealing with.
So nobody really knows what you were dealing with?
No. Nor will they.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sample, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
So, to go back to post-1994 World Cup, you're dealing with a lot of things. You overcome it, right? Because you eventually go on to have, you know, a career season for Kansas City when you have 16 shutouts in a season. Yeah. Wouldn't you say that's your best season?
Weren't you MLS MVP as a
goalie? I was, yeah.
Which is, that's rare. That's
rare
to be a
goalie. It's going to be hard to do now. It's going to be hard for someone to do that now.
Why?
Obviously, more teams... we have more foreign players in the league that are bigger names, and I think sometimes it becomes a popularity contest when you vote, right?
Oh, okay.
I'm not discrediting anyone that's ever won it before. I just think, like, you know, you have fans involved, you have media involved, and you have player. I always looked at every year I look at the player votes, which counts for 1/3 of the votes. That's why I think it's going to be hard to do again.
Yeah.
You know,
really,
I mean,
really difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, 16 shutouts is crazy.
Yeah, we were good that year. We took pride in defending, but we're also the third highest scoring team in the league, which people seem to forget for whatever reason, because there were a bunch of big games where we won 1-0.
Did you win the league that year?
We did.
Supporter Shield?
We won everything.
That's crazy.
We were in first place from start to finish.
Man, you took home a lot that year.
Yeah.
But that team gets overlooked whenever anyone's talking about greatest MLS teams. No one ever seems to bring up that Kansas City side. Why do you think
that's right, man? I got the ring. I remind myself all the time, though. It's, it was a good team. I mean, we were stacked, man, with that group.
When was the crossover? Like, because you've played against each other. Charlie, have you played against Tony or no?
No.
But you have played.
Yeah, we played against each other 2004 and 2005.
2 years, yeah. I remember.
You were where at the time?
I was in for 1 year in Kansas City and then 1 year in, started the season as the Metro Stars and through preseason became the Red Bulls.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You enjoy scoring past him?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to, you know, so you score against a legend, you know what I mean? So, like...
Did you score on me?
Yeah, man, check the tape. Where's the tape at?
I'm sure you're going to roll it somewhere.
I mean, it was anytime you could go against, you know, the people that inspired you, like that 94 World Cup, I remember going and watching games in Dallas and watching y'all on TV and just seeing, you know, that run and getting out of that group. What was that like? Because the U.S. is going to experience that. Playing a World Cup in your own country and, you know, the challenge that you had in front of you and the expectations that were on your shoulders.
Well, the experience was incredible because I don't know that the players now will feel so much shock at the World Cup when they see filled stadiums and, you know, this whole buildup going to the World Cup, because I think they're... The players now are a little bit more programmed based on what happens at their clubs. And we got guys playing. You guys played at big clubs. You know, so, you know, we didn't have that buildup. Like, we didn't have that. It wasn't until, like, 2 months before the World Cup that the general public knew that the World Cup was coming to the U.S. Mm. I mean, really coming. We knew it was going to be here, but no one really, half the country had no idea really what the World Cup was, right? And I don't know that that's going to be the case in 2026. I think we're so much more prepared now.
But that pressure, you know what I mean? Know that, like, you have a World Cup at home. You don't know if you're going to ever get that opportunity again. They're going to have that same pressure on their shoulders. And then also the pressure of, like, to do well, to start a professional league.
It's even more. No host country had ever not made it to the next round.
Oh, wow.
Right? So, hell, if we wanted to be the first ones, right, to do it, I give that group so much credit because it will never happen again. You had two jobs when you played on the national team, that group that was living in Mission Viejo. You were a player from 9 o'clock until whatever, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, whenever you left. And you were promoting the game 24 hours a day. Mm. We did everything. Every talk show, every school book reading, like you from top to bottom, we did it because we had to. Every time we went to a city, pretty much the first day in that city, you train, and it was dedicated to scattering 25 guys around the city to promote the game.
Like, are you glad that you played in that generation, or if you could swap it, you would take this generation?
No, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I really wouldn't.
Despite the money, despite the accessibility to Europe, all of that.
No, I would keep it just the way it is. That group of players, and we did the $1 billion goal documentary. That group, and that 94 group are so special to this game. I hope that people realize it. Mm. I'm lucky enough to have lived it with them, so I know firsthand how special they were, how much they cared about the game, and how much they cared to do something that our national team had never done before. Mm. So I wouldn't take any of that back.
Should you ever set foot outside of the hotel, you will be shot.
Don't miss the new Showtime limited series based on the international bestseller.
For the last 4 years, I've been a prisoner.
Why are they keeping you here?
Starring Emmy Award winner Ewan McGregor.
This is the brave new world that you dreamt of.
Be very careful. You are still a prisoner here.
Everything in this new world comes at cost.
This is still my country.
A Gentleman in Moscow. Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Only with the Paramount Plus with Showtime plan.
Do you think your generation had an understanding of what they had sacrificed to pave that way for you, or do you think it wasn't kind of?
I don't think I had an idea of that. As much as what y'all sacrificed and how hard you had to promote it, and you talk about those interviews, I was, you know, even during my time, I was kind of like the current players. I would say, you know, you just focus on playing. You were tired. You didn't want to do something unless it was, you know, absolutely needed to do it. It wasn't like you just take on everything that you could do because you wanted to have that energy to still be able to perform. And for y'all to be doing, running, and doing everything, and then still having that energy to play at a top level and get out of that group and deal with all that kind of pressure is crazy. I mean, I have an appreciation for what y'all did because y'all allowed me to, like, realize a dream. Because growing up, it was always the biggest thing you could do is play for your country. That's all I prayed about. That's all I dreamed about as a kid. I want to represent my country and to score a goal in the World Cup. But after 94, you had that thought, man, I might can play professional soccer and be able to take care of my family in some type of way and be a kid for a longer period of time. So that wasn't even a hope for me as a kid that there would be a professional soccer until after that. It was, the only dream was, can you play for your country and play in a World Cup?
Mm. Yeah, it was a different time. So my point is, like, I think about why I wouldn't change. I think about how special that group was. That 90 team that we did the documentary about, I was lucky. I mean, I was in college at the time. I really had no worry because it was still part of the path. Some of those guys had already started making their way in, like, the business world. Mm. And then they'd get called in for a World Cup qualifier, you know, and they were training at night on fields with college teams or youth teams, and because there was nowhere to play. And if you think about that now, it makes no sense, right? That would never happen again anywhere. Mm. It wasn't like you could have, like, you know, training centers that just to go lift weights and do speed, like, that didn't exist.
I think it reminds me how young the game is here in terms of, that's astounding to me that's really not all that long ago.
But you know what else is crazy? By listening to the story and knowing more about what's going on, because there's only so much that I knew, but how much y'all did to, like, grow the game and, like, perform, get out of the group, and them not having a professional league in place, and then you coming back and, you know, them feeling a certain type of way after everything that you did to grow it to where it was, that it's like, I never thought I'd see you play for this federation again. Like, how were you able to, like, take that on the chin and be like, you know what, this is fucked up, bro.
Right.
Because I love the game, you know, and that's how I framed it in my head, man. I love the game. I love talking about the game and analyzing it and you know, that's why this, like, all this stuff is so uncomfortable to me, because this isn't really my love. Like, I love our game, like, and I love seeing it grow. And I feel like I'm one of the few guys that are currently in the game that know it from the start, right?
Yeah.
I know what happened in 86. I know when we lost to Costa Rica and I was sitting in front of the TV. I don't know if you guys know what happened. And
I was born in 86. So.
But I'm saying, you understand my point? Like, I know it. And I'm like, that was the first moment for me where I said, I'm going to go to a World Cup. Like, how stupid was that? I was 17 years old. Like, it's the dumbest thing you could say, but I'm going to go to the World Cup, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I knew that I heard them say, the U.S. doesn't qualify for the World Cup once again. You know, I'm like... Yeah. No, we'll get there. You know, like, it's a stupid thing to say when you're a kid, but it's a dream, right? Yeah, and that's what I felt.
Not that I felt it to the extreme that you felt it, but I always felt like, you know what? Every time that I represented the U.S. and played against other teams, I was like, I'm gonna show these motherfuckers what's up. I'm gonna show them that we know how to play. We're not just, like, can kick and run. We got skill. We can take people on. And it pissed me off that we were looked at like, you know what I'm saying? Especially with my Latin friends growing up. I felt a certain way, like, I'm gonna show you motherfuckers, dude, that these Americans can play. And it's kind of like that chip on your shoulder that, like, I've always felt when I represented the national team.
Yeah.
When you, because you loved the game so much, when you knew it was coming to the end for retirement, did you want to step away? Or did you want to, like, get right back into, you know, being a coach, being
just
in the locker
room? Just for the record, I never officially retired, so I'm still available.
Get away from those Open Cup games.
No, I'm done. So I stepped away for 2 years, man, because of the way I was released. I mean, I was released in an email from Bruce Arena. You know, I was released, and I went to his office, and I said, man, I've been here every day. I didn't play at the end of the year. You sent me an email like 3 weeks ago saying how you've been such a great soldier. I know you're not playing. I know it must be tough at the end of your career, but I made a decision to go with another goalkeeper. You've been such a great teammate to everybody. I said, you could have told me that, like, to my face, yeah. You know, like, and then I get released via email, and I said, you know, I've known you forever. And I didn't care to talk to Bruce for like 3 or 4 years. Now we're good. Like, I talked to him like nothing happened.
Yeah. You're a better man than me. I couldn't go up to somebody and just talk like nothing happened.
Well, here's Clint, you know,
but I respect it. You know what I'm saying?
Here's the thing. I get what you're saying, but we got to work in this game together.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we're in a position to not work together in our country. Mm. I don't think there's so much fighting in our country.
There is a lot of division. I agree with that.
Within soccer.
Yeah, especially the club system, everything. Mm-hmm. You're not having the best teams always playing each other. You're not having to play your way into the best league. You're just in the league, you know?
How about you have to get accepted to be in leagues? Like, if you created a club and you got your club team.
Yeah.
Some clubs, leagues will say, no, you're not.
Keep you from joining that.
You can't join our league. And you're like, what?
It's just too much, man. It really is. And I don't know that there's a solution, but I wasn't going to be, I guess my point is I wasn't going to be part of the problem. Mm. We can do more good together than we can do being divided, going in different ways.
New CBS Monday. NCIS is back.
We need all hands on deck.
So grab your gear.
NCIS!
And join our elite team.
What are the charges?
Murder.
New cases to be solved.
Double tap to the chest.
Same caliber as the murder weapon.
And new criminals to catch.
That's the bomb maker. Where's the bomb?
A new NCIS, Monday, 9, 8 Central, on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
Do you feel like you're at peace, though? Like, it feels like you had to bottle a lot of stuff inside. And
man,
do you feel like...
Clint, I'm so at peace right now.
That's good.
Because I told you, I don't like talking about myself, but if you want to talk about my kids and seeing them have success and going to watch games and
your boy at Oklahoma balling out.
OSU.
OSU, my bad.
Not Oklahoma. That's a big difference.
I got close. I'm close.
You're in the right state.
Hitting home runs for fun.
Yeah, that's for me. Like, I'm the ultimate, like, fan, man, of my kids. And seeing them play, you know, it's been, I guess I'm on, like, 10 years in a row of college sports. You know, between my three kids, mm-hmm. Jonathan played, my daughter Kylie, she's the only one who played soccer. Mm-hmm. Now my son's playing baseball, and it's...
Can I ask a question? And this maybe sounds super stereotypical, right? But coming from Europe, that's why I asked the question. Like, I remember growing up, my dad played football with his son, but he never played with me. That just wasn't even a thought to him. He did other sports with me. He took me to track and field and to whatever else, but just soccer, it was never a concept for mm-hmm. him. Let me play soccer with my daughter. I guess you coming from an Italian family and having that kind of European mindset, did you have to adjust to thinking about your daughter playing soccer, or was that always just a given to you?
No, it was a given. I'd coached my oldest in multiple sports. And then it was kind of my daughter's turn, right? Mm-hmm. And my wife said to me, you need to spend some time coaching Kylie at some point. And I was like, Colleen, no way, man. I'm not doing it, you know? I don't relate to these 11-year-old girls, right? I just don't relate. I love my daughter to death. Like, uh-huh. I want to, you know, hug her 24 hours a day. But I don't know how to coach. Like, I'm scared, you know?
Uh-huh.
And... a year later, I did it. And I came back from the first training session, and my wife was like, how is it? I'm like, I'm doing my penance right now. That's what I'm doing right now. It was the best 5 years of my life.
Why?
Coaching. How many hours my daughter and I spent in the car driving mm-hmm. to tournaments. There were times where I would take, you know, a couple of players, you know, her friends in the car. We'd drive to a tournament. I wouldn't say a word and just listen. And I guarantee you, I don't have a picture, but I guarantee you I was smiling, just driving the car, just listening. And now my daughter's 22 years old. She's in the workforce now. She loves the game. She'll sit down. If I'm watching a Champions League game, she'll sit down and ask me. She loves the game, right? And she and I are like this. It became one of the coolest parenting experiences I had. Mm. I didn't know what I was getting into.
Okay, can you give us a perspective of being the daughter in that situation?
No, that's why that made me emotional. So I just lost my dad in December.
Sorry, Kate.
And
Like, the time that I spent with him in sports was everything to me. So hearing how much that meant to you was like, it was special, because I think we all know, like, sports teaches you character, right? Like, so much of what is special about sports is that it teaches you determination, commitment, you know, durability, resilience. The fact you have to stick with things. And so much of what I enjoy about, like, who my dad was the example that he was to me, the good character I saw in him, but also just, like, man, the fun we had in those moments. And I remember, I'm divorced, I got married a while ago. And when he gave the speech at my wedding, one of the things he said to me, you know, you'll look back at some point in your life and you'll never wish that you spent more time at work. What you will always value is family and those moments that you had. And yeah, it's just dope to hear what it means to another father.
Because
that bond is so special.
Yeah, I think if my kids sat here today and you asked them, like, what's one lesson your dad gave you? I've told them that they have to promise me that they spend more time with their kids than I actually spent with them.
That's what I need to do a better job of, especially with my oldest daughter. It's hard for me to go to the game and not have such high expectations that it's hard for her to put on her. I need to be more, just be there for her and you know, support her a little bit better. And I'm glad that we were able to have this conversation because it puts things in a better perspective. And I think I lose that sometimes. But that's kind of how I feel with my oldest. I'm the toughest on her of all of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, in life, I feel like your greatest strength can be your greatest weakness, yeah. Right? And you're a winner.
Yeah.
That's who you are, and that's why you are who you were on the field.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, can that have a knock-on effect? And it can be hard to just allow someone else to just be in a space and not want them to win the way you wanted to. I'm sure that's hard.
That's what I got to do. That's what I got to grow up and get in that space and do a better job of making the time count more.
When I left the game, I left for 2 years, man. I was out. I never thought I'd be in this sport again. I was out. I got so engulfed in my family and my kids. Like, that was joy. I didn't know how I was going to make a living. I thought I'd go and build houses. That's what I thought I'd do. I mean, because that's my whole family's in construction business and, you know, in the labor field. And I thought that's what I would do. And it would have been fine with me as long as I had enough time with my kids to spend and go to practices and all that stuff. And then this freaking media thing happened.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got here 12 years later, but I'm here. Like,
And I got to say, when I retired, I wasn't sure exactly what lane I was going to go down. But then I said, okay, media is interesting to me. And so, you know, you're trying to do as much as you can. Take reps, you know, radio if you can, TV. And so SiriusXM, Brian Dunseth reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested in filling in here and there? And then that's when I got to work with Tony for the first time. And you were so helpful, giving me advice, just making it easy for me to feel comfortable and tell me things that I should focus on. So, you know, I can't thank you enough. I always looked up to you and a lot of the guys that came before me, because I always, like you have respect because of the foundation you set for us. I knew that 94 team in particular. Now that I know Billion Dollar Goal, I know a lot more. But in 94, I thought, wow, this team is what allowed MLS to be born, right? And so, you know, I looked up to you guys, and then for you to help me on the opposite end, you know, further down the line was really special. So I can't thank you enough for making
man,
that.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's our job, man. That's why when I tell you, I don't want to hold a grudge. Like, that's our job, is to push the ball down the hill, man, you know, and the snowball's got to get bigger somehow. And if we don't do it, you know, I feel like there's no one from the outside that's going to do it. I told you I was coaching, and I was going to get to that. I spent 5.5 years with the youth national teams. And I thought my relationship at U.S. Soccer was great, and Tab made it great for all of us. Brad Friedel was there. I mean, he was bringing guys in everywhere. And the kids really enjoyed it.
I think there's something to be said for players who knew the weight it was to wear the jersey, and also mm-hmm. could demonstrate what they were saying in terms of the coaching. Because for me, when you can see that, you know, someone, you know, played the game and can demonstrate what they're talking about, there's just a different level of respect than someone just saying, hey, you need to do this. And then, like, they can't even juggle the ball. And you're just like,
how are you going to tell me like how to do something and you can't even demonstrate it?
Right.
So.
But just to like if I'm right now, if I'm 15 years old and Clint Dempsey walks in, like, honestly, I'm not saying this because you're sitting here. I the two best players for me that we've ever produced are Clint Dempsey and Tab Ramos. Those are them. I don't tell you because you're here, because I've said it 100 times on the radio. I don't need you to be here for me to tell you that. Like, Clint Dempsey walks in a room and I'm 15 years old and I'm an attacking player. I don't care how many. I'm a goalkeeper. I'm like, God damn, that's Clint Dempsey. Uh-huh. Like, Charlie Davies, like, because the way Tab did it, Tab would let, when he set the camp up, he'd let the players know who's going to be, who the coaches are going to be. So you know already parents are looking up this stuff and who the assistant coaches are. And then when he got there, like, he made an introduction. He had videos. It was so cool because I think it's so important for our youth national teams to have that. We do have a history. It's not the deepest history. It's not like England. It's not like, I get it, but we have a history.
I didn't say that as a diss, by the way.
I didn't take it as that.
Oh, okay.
But we have to, but I think we forget our history sometime, even as short as it. We should know most of the history because it's not nearly as long as some of the others, right? So, yeah, I don't think we do a great job of that currently, and I hope that changes.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Just in terms of, like, history of any club that you play for, whether it's MLS and they don't have a big history, or, you know, with the national team, like, I didn't know that much about the billion-dollar goal other than the fact he scored the goal that got, you know, qualified for the World Cup, Caligiuri, but I didn't know everything else that kind of went into that. So I think there is a lot that's kind of missed. And even, you know, the education of U.S. Open Cup, I didn't know about some of that when we talked about it. It was always like, when I was playing in the U.S. Open Cup, and no disrespect, I was like, oh, man, what are we doing this for? Like, you know, I didn't respect it like I should have, because I didn't know the history about it. And I think that's because, to your point, you know, you don't get that all the time.
You're obviously so invested, right, in growing the game and in what soccer can still become in this country and the further progress it can make. 2026, how optimistic are you about what that changes for this country and what happens with the game?
Kate, if it's half the springboard that 1994 was, if I had a nickel for every time someone said 1994 is when I got turned on to the game, right? I'd be a rich man, because that was such a special moment in our country in a time where we didn't know a lot about the game, right? We didn't have this rich history, first time ever. We know how to put on events in this country like nobody else.
Amen, that's true. Right? Very true.
Right.
Final in New Jersey.
Final in the great state of New Jersey.
You've got to be hyped about that one, right?
Yeah. And how, I mean, what else could we ask for in this? I'd like to think, and I said this the night we did not make the World Cup, I said, this team is built for 2026. Because I'd been with the youth national teams at that point for a while. I'm like, 2026, this is when this team will peak. And I still think, and I know there's a lot of shit that goes around the national team, and there's talk all the time about getting, I still think when we get there, we'll be able to show the world that we can play.
I hate to cut this short, but we do have to wrap because we've taken a bunch of your time. I feel like I got to know you a lot better on this show. And just a couple of things, I have so much respect for the fact that picture behind you is the 2002 team, because I think in your position, it would be so easy to have the picture up where you were a star, right? 1990, 1994. For you to say, oh, but it's the fight back, right? That's what matters to me. I know what it costs to get back to that team. I think that says so much about your character. And whatever it is that you're protecting that hurts so much, I think that's really dope that you say, you know what, this is my choice. I'm going to keep that private.
Yep.
And I have a lot of respect for that. So God bless you. Thank you so much for coming through.
Thanks, guys.
I appreciate it.
Sir. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, bro.
All right, buddy.
Appreciate you.
Love you, brother.
Thanks.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus. Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire, now streaming on Paramount+.